Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. War propaganda is not new, but the current proliferation of fake news and misinformation delivered by way of social media has become the new normal in the seemingly unending spiral of international conflict. Websites such as Facebook, Twitter, and Google attempt to moderate what users share on their platforms, but experts say the sheer quantity of malicious content, whether from ISIS jihadists or Russian political operatives, is too much to contain. Journalist David Patrikarakos has written about the issue in his new book entitled War in 140 Characters, How Social Media is Reshaping Conflict in the 21st Century. He joins us by phone. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Good morning. And thank you very much for inviting me on.
You know, we keep hearing fake news and malicious content and that kind of thing. We don't often use the word propaganda when we talk about the impact of social media.
Yeah, I mean, I actually think you hit on a very good point immediately. I dislike the term fake news because it is not news in any traditional sense of the word. What it is, as you accurately say, it's propaganda. It's lies. You know, Hillary Clinton supposedly running a pedophile ring out of a pizzeria is not fake news. It's lies. So I think immediately we have a problem with terminology. And as you say, you know, especially in conflict, propaganda is nothing new. It's as old as conflict itself. It's as old as politics itself. But, you know, given new information tools that have arrived with the digital revolution, notably social media, Twitter, Facebook, the speed and the scope with which propaganda and disinformation can reach people is unprecedented in human history.
You know, when I think of propaganda, I think of those little leaflets they used to drop from planes during the World War II and stuff, right? But that's where everyone was sort of getting the same thing at the same time. And with social media, it's so personalized now.
You're absolutely right. And again, you've hit the nail on the head. I mean, what we have now is a balkanized information environment, and that is dangerous. And you have to understand, as I always say, you know, the story of social media is very much, in a way, the story of the rise and fall of hope. We thought these new information tools, you know, they are transnational. You know, if you have a friend, Anne, in London, you can, you know, hop on your Facebook Messenger and talk to him or her instantly. So, they thought they were going to bring us all together in a great unifying whole. And to a degree, they have brought us together. But what they've also done is they've split us apart. Now, they do this in two ways. The first is obvious. During times of political or indeed, actual military crisis, we have platforms with which to argue with people. So if you're a Trumpkin, you will argue with, anti-Trumpists. If you're for Brexit, you argue with anti-Brexit people. If you're pro-Palestinian, you can directly argue with pro-Israelis. The second, though, is more insidious. And that is, on our social media platforms like Facebook, while our friends, quote unquote, because obviously it's a different meaning than in real life, while if you're a Democrat, not all your friends are going to be Democrats, you will largely be broadly similar. That is to say, and I'm sure you are not friends with many neo-Nazis or jihadists online. Mm-hmm. So what happens is they will post content, from articles that you may not always agree with, but they'll be within your realms within the realms of acceptability. If they're not, generally, if you find events, you'll unfriend them. So you start to become cocooned in more or less an echo chamber. The second thing is that the Facebook algorithm, it starts to feed you content based on what you like. So what happens is your information reality is constructed to conform to your likes. Now, in politics, in military conflict, this is very dangerous because what happens is a total inability to see the other side, because it's not that, 20 years ago, a war would be covered by CNN or the BBC, an election would be covered by the same. And, with their required standards of impartiality, with journalistic standards, now you get, if you're a real Trumpkin, you go to Breitbart, you can go to 4chan, you can go to any number of sources that will give you all your information. And that will construct your reality. 20 years ago, look, Democrats and Republicans would have watched the same information. They would have come to different conclusions, mm-hmm. but at least they would have watched the same product that was done to a particular standard. That doesn't exist anymore. And that is dangerous because it makes us more divisive, it makes hatred flourish more, and it makes conflict easier.
We're talking about propaganda by way of social media. My guest is David Patrikarakos. He's a journalist and author of War in 140 Characters. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Besides the fact that the president of the United States is one of the most prolific tweeters I've ever seen. It's the first thing I do every morning is check Twitter to see what
Absolutely.
He's done.
Absolutely. But I mean, Donald Trump could not be possible in a pre-social media age. And I mean, Trump, you know, for all that he is ignorant, and I personally think not especially intelligent, he is smart. And he understands that, you know, a tweet can dominate an entire news cycle. Mm-hmm. And this is, you know, this is what he uses it to very good effect, because just think of some of the things he said or tweeted. They would have finished a previous president or a previous presidential candidate. But, you know, he tweets so much and he tweets such ridiculous stuff that essentially there becomes a fatigue, because, you know, you can only become outraged so many times over the space of a week. And in a sense, you see a great inuring. You know, Trump will tweet something and, you know, we the media will go, aha, you spelled your wrong. And this is dangerous because norms are being eroded.
I wonder if he actually knows that he's doing that. But for sure, that technique is used by other organizations that are very circumspect. They're very methodical about how they're doing that.
Absolutely. I mean, again, one of the great questions I want to know is this all just, is he, you know, such a media genius, or is he, you know, verbally incontinent? I suspect it's a bit of both. But absolutely, because, you know, we have now the ability to make things go viral. And unfortunately, what goes viral is not something that's good quality, but something that's sensationalist. And, you know, platforms like Twitter, even though they've just doubled the character limit, they don't reward nuance. They don't reward deep thinking. What they reward are sensationalist statements, accusations, counter-accusations, abuse. And this is very, very unhealthy for our information ecosystem, if you like. But it is also perfect for someone like Donald Trump.
It's also perfect for something like ISIS. But I heard an interview with a general who said they've discovered something. ISIS has discovered something that recruiting by way of social media is very effective, but actually finding good soldiers is not easy by social media.
Absolutely. Look, you know, you can reach people with social medias in a way you never could before. But you've got to look at the quality of what you're reaching. You know, it's usually young, marginalized people. Maybe they don't fit in for whatever reason. You know, they're misfits. I mean, it doesn't take, you know, an ordinary, balanced, highly qualified, I mean, you know, person is unlikely to make the trek from New York or London or Paris or Brussels to join ISIS. It's not always the case. Mm-hmm. You do sometimes. But generally, yes, he's absolutely right. You can reach a lot of people. But the people who are likely to be swayed by your propaganda are, you know, people who are likely to be vulnerable, not very intelligent, emotionally immature. So, yes, you can get a lot of people, but not a lot of very high-quality people who would make good soldiers.
The U.S., of course, is investigating Russian meddling in the 2016 election cycle. What is Russia's history with this sort of operation? It's not the first time to the rodeo for them.
Oh, absolutely not. I mean, look, Russians, I think, really honed this technique in 2014 with Ukraine. Now, there is a thing called the Gerasimov Doctrine, and it's named after Vitaly Gerasimov, who is the sort of head of the Russian military. And, you know, I mean, there's a long quote, but essentially he says, you know, we are finding out that non-military means are more effective than military means. So if you look at what happened in East Ukraine, Putin, you know, he never rolled into East Ukraine with the intention of defeating the Ukrainian army and seizing Ukraine. That was never his goal. The goal was to, you know, occupy parts of the East in order to then, you know, be allowed to pump in enough propaganda to make Eastern Ukrainians believe that the Kiev government was a fascist junta, something I heard over and over again, and that it wanted to persecute Russian speakers and eliminate the speaking of Russian, which is obviously very prevalent in Eastern Ukraine. So this is, you know, propaganda getting people to subscribe to a particular narrative. And it's the same thing in a military context. It was still a political goal. And, you know, it's the same thing with Trump. It's like, well, Hillary is a pedophile, or Hillary is totally corrupt, or Hillary is this and Hillary is that. So they hone these techniques to real perfection in the Ukraine war. And, you know, ever since then, you know, they've been doing it ever since. They did it in America. They tried to do it in France. No, but it was really honed in Ukraine in 2014.
What can a government do to counter those efforts?
Well, I mean, I think as we're seeing with the tech hearings, the first thing is a realization that, you know, social media companies, I mean, we think of, because, I mean, the very term platform has this, you know, neutral idea about it. We think they're these neutral spaces where we can all jump on and chat to our friends. But they're not. What they are is businesses. They're capitalist enterprises, which is fair enough, mm-hmm. designed to make money. And, you know, and their money is a product, and their product is us, their users. And that means two things. First of all, it means they want to keep us on there for as long as possible so they can advertise it, can sell us stuff. And the second thing is they're ill-served by kicking us off their platforms. They don't want to kick users off their platforms. Now, what this means is, you know, it took years for ISIS fanboys to be kicked off Twitter. It was only after the beheading of the journalist James Foley that it really started. And secondly, you know, they don't really want to, you know, they want people to advertise. So essentially what is happening is, what can the government do? Well, the government is going to have to have some sort of legislative intervention against the social media companies, because they've proved that self-policing does not work. Even at the tech hearings, they said a few, you know, the right words, grudgingly, reluctantly. And obviously there is a dilemma here, because there is a free speech issue, and free speech is sacrosanct. We have the First Amendment, and rightly so. But there is a clear distinction between a free speech and incitement to violence. One is legal, one is illegal, and there is still too much content that is direct incitement to violence that should not be there. The second thing is, as what's happening now is, they're going to have to, you know, regulate how, you know, and what, you know, they're going to have to stop the proliferation of fake news. And if the platforms won't do it themselves, and I doubt that they will, mm-hmm. the government is going to have to step in. It's going to have to come at the legislative level now. That much is clear.
Well, what about everyday people? I mean, I know in some schools they're starting to educate kids about how to identify, fake content. What can everyday people do?
Again, you've hit the nail on the head. We need to teach social media literacy. I mean, there's a kind of post-truth toolkit that I sort of have come up with, and it's like there's certain things we all have to be aware of. And I mean, for a start, I always recommend people, look, you know, don't read just what your friends post. Go directly to news sites you trust, be that the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Guardian in England, CNN, BBC, whatever. Go directly to the site, you know, and read, you know, it's reporting. Don't just cherry-pick articles that you like. The second thing is, you know, read, you know, newspapers or other publications or websites that you don't agree with. I don't mean go and read Breitbart, but if you're a Democrat, you know, read the Wall Street Journal. You will learn things. The third thing I say is, look, don't confuse popularity with quality. Just because something goes viral doesn't mean it's good. In fact, often it's the opposite. Read books. You know, you will learn things. They still exist. And finally, honestly, log off. You know, don't spend all your time on social media platforms. They will suck your life, and they're actually bad for your mental health. So try to regulate how much you do gawk at your Facebook home feed or your Twitter timeline, because it's unhealthy how much we do it now.
You know, these are just, I'm not saying just, I didn't mean it sound dismissive, but they're rules, and they're good rules. But I remember when we were learning how to use a dictionary back in the, you know, the dark ages, and we actually had to be taught how to use it. Someone did just slap a dictionary on my desk and tell me to use it.
Sure.
I had to be taught how to use it.
Exactly, which is why, as you said, you know, there needs to be social media literacy taught in schools. Because, I mean, you and I mean, we can remember when we didn't get all our information, you know, from the internet and mainly social media.
Mm-hmm.
But children today, I mean, they will grow up and that will be it. There has to be an understanding of how you use this literally, you know, how you can be literate in your use of social media, how you can use it responsibly, and how, most of all, you can identify disinformation from information, because that is the greatest threat we have. And we are seeing its effect on politics and on conflict. And the end result is someone like Donald Trump.
David Patrikarakos, thanks so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
David Patrikarakos has written about the issue in his new book. It's entitled War in 140 Characters, How Social Media is Reshaping Conflict in the 21st Century. More Tech Tuesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Collecting and selling data is the business model for many companies in Silicon Valley. That data is valuable. Last year, Microsoft bought LinkedIn, the leader in work-related social media and data collection, for more than $26 billion. How other smaller tech companies have tapped that data has led to lawsuits. Joining us now by phone is staff writer at Bloomberg Businessweek, Drake Bennett. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
First of all, for folks who may not be aware of what LinkedIn is and how big it is, could you give us a little, the primer on that?
Sure. It's the world's biggest professional networking site. So it's basically a social media site, but for your work life. So a lot of what's on there is people posting basically rich forms of their resume and updating it when they take a new class or something interesting happens at work right now there's really no meaningful competition in that space to LinkedIn. They have 500 million users and it's a real gold mine for recruiters looking for people to fill particular jobs.
Right. So the recruiters are looking on it. Does everybody on LinkedIn know what the recruiters are looking at?
Probably not. I think like, say, a Facebook or a Google in different ways, one helpful way to think about LinkedIn is that all of us that have profiles on it aren't really the primary customers in a way. The bulk of the money that LinkedIn makes is actually by charging recruiters a lot of money to have these kind of premium recruiter memberships that give them all sorts of tools to find people and reach out to them just at the right moment when they might be most receptive to hearing about some great new opportunity.
Is that when someone asks you to, link up with them on LinkedIn, is that what they need to do that in order to get access to your information or not?
No, recruiters don't. They basically have visibility, with a few exceptions on just everyone on LinkedIn, anything that's on LinkedIn is basically visible to people who have these premium recruiter memberships.
So then why did LinkedIn send a cease and desist letter to another company called HiQ Labs? Can you talk about what they did and with the data from LinkedIn and what they did that didn't follow the rules LinkedIn wanted them to?
Right. So HiQ, maybe just to step back, the way a lot of the internet is set up right now is that you have these very big companies like the Facebooks, the Googles, and, in the professional networking space, LinkedIn, which is owned by Microsoft, as you mentioned. Mm-hmm. And then you have all these little companies that are trying to make their money by piggybacking on these giant companies. So HiQ is one of those. And what they do is they offer what they call people analytics services to HR departments, which means they try to take data about employees and make predictions about what they might do, in particular if they're thinking of leaving for another job, which is something that your boss or the HR department of your company might be very interested in knowing. And the data source for that is exclusively LinkedIn data. And LinkedIn decided they didn't want them doing this anymore, and so sent them a letter back in May kicking them off the site, which basically would have been putting this smaller startup out of business. HiQ, the startup, in response, sued, setting off this legal battle that ended up attracting some very high-profile legal talent because it's probably going to have some pretty big ramifications for who gets to decide what happens to the information that all of us are increasingly putting online.
How did LinkedIn know that HiQ Labs was doing that?
Well, they have all sorts of defenses they've set up, technological defenses to prevent what's called data scraping. Data scraping is a pretty broad term. It basically means using software to collect copied data at really large volumes that you can then analyze. It's used, it's used by hackers. It's also used by Google to index the web. So LinkedIn was aware of this just because they noticed that HiQ's programmers were scraping their data. You know, and also HiQ is pretty upfront about this, and LinkedIn employees had actually corresponded with HiQ about what they were doing. So it wasn't a kind of a surreptitious effort. LinkedIn had actually sent employees to a conference that HiQ organizes about people analytics. So there's some question as to why LinkedIn chose to go after them when they did. Mm-hmm. LinkedIn's argument is that this is something that its members would not want to happen and didn't sign up for when they opened their LinkedIn accounts and put their information on LinkedIn. HiQ's response is that it has more to do with the fact that LinkedIn is interested in getting into this business itself, which does make a certain amount of sense because they have all this information. So especially at a time when they're Microsoft is trying to figure out how to make money off of this very large acquisition it made, they're moving fairly aggressively into this big data world.
What are the privacy concerns at play for LinkedIn users? What do I care if I'm on LinkedIn that HiQ Labs is using the data to make, for these kind of analyses?
It's part of this larger set of technologies that's sort of challenging the traditional understanding of what's private and what's public information. So what HiQ is doing and what a lot of big data companies are doing is subjecting this data to analyses that might actually be able to unearth stuff that we didn't intend to make public, right? So when we go on LinkedIn, when we update our profile, when we do whatever we're doing on LinkedIn, we might not be intending to make it clear to, say, our employer that we're looking for another job. That could have negative ramifications at work. And so, HiQ's argument is we're just using the information that LinkedIn users have designated as the most as public, stuff that anyone on the internet can see with a Google search. LinkedIn's response is that, well, yes, but that word means different things now than it used to, and it's something that obviously is important in terms of data on the internet. But there's all sorts of other realms where technology is sort of, these GPS tracking has sort of changed. The Supreme Court has decided that GPS tracking has changed what it means to do a search and seizure of someone's car. So there are all these ways in which being able to massage this data, to collect it, to analyze it at scale really fast, are kind of breaking down some of the public-private protections we've traditionally had.
And again, for listeners, they should be aware that this isn't necessarily altruistic on the part of LinkedIn. It's clear, as we mentioned, that Microsoft just bought it for $26 billion. There's business here.
Yeah. No, I think basically everyone on the internet, with a few exceptions, is making their money by using data to figure out how to, sell ads to you, how to, sell, Amazon's using it to figure out what you want to buy on Amazon. Mm-hmm. And so this is part of that trend where LinkedIn has all of this information about you. I mean, the information that you as a user put on LinkedIn is yours, and LinkedIn's privacy policy, their various policies make that very clear. But it's also this rich source for LinkedIn to figure out, in their case, it's really about enabling these recruiters to kind of find you at your moment of perfect ripeness for a recruiting pitch. And, that's not a bad thing. Maybe it's good to be offered new jobs and you can use that for leverage in your old job or whatever. But it is also something where the control is moving away from the user, and you are the sort of target of this increasingly sophisticated analysis. And so people should just be aware of that.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act and the role it plays in this case.
That is the federal law that LinkedIn largely relied on in its cease and desist letter, and it's a very controversial law. It dates; it's been amended, but it, in its original form, it dates back to the mid '80s, and it was originally meant to protect against. I don't know if you remember that Matthew Broderick movie War Games, but mm-hmm. against that actual scenario, someone taking over a computer and a hacker taking over a computer and using it to do something dangerously mischievous. But it's been repurposed more recently by companies like Facebook and Craigslist and LinkedIn to prosecute people for visiting websites. So basically it makes it a federal crime to have unauthorized access to a computer. And that doesn't mean anymore, courts have decided, that you have to literally break into a computer lab and sign on. You can literally, that can mean right. going onto a website. So what this case was trying to decide, and the reason you had Larry Tribe from Harvard and Don Verrilli, former Solicitor General of the United States, arguing on either side of it, was that this is trying to set the boundaries of what counts as unauthorized access. You know, by some standards, giving someone else your password and having them sign on to something could be unauthorized access. That could be a federal crime. Mm-hmm. So this is policing that boundary, where HiQ is saying, no, we should be very careful about criminalizing this stuff, and LinkedIn saying, the law is clear. These people were trespassing, and it's no different from if they were trespassed. They broke into our, offices.
Some argue that LinkedIn and other companies are creating data monopolies this way. I mean, you look at everything that Microsoft owns. Is that a fair assessment? Is that a serious concern?
Yeah, I mean, I think LinkedIn is no Facebook. It's no Google, but in the space that it is in, it's totally dominant. And the thing about these data-based companies is that as they do get better at using this information to predict the choices of their users, then there's this fear that they'll be able to control those choices. And so, traditionally, when we think about monopolies, it's all about, well, is pricing competitive? Are these monopolies using their market power to jack up prices? But there's this new issue, which is, are they using their monopoly power to make it harder for you to choose any of their competitors? It's hard to imagine. It's difficult to imagine a real competitor to LinkedIn arising, because they would need all of the data on LinkedIn to become the next LinkedIn, and LinkedIn is clearly not interested in letting that happen. And with a Facebook, it's an even more I think it's an even stronger case that there's something to really drive us to rethink how we protect against these really, really dominant market players.
So what was the final ruling in the case between LinkedIn and HiQ Labs? What happened?
So the federal judge, Judge Chen, so what was going on here was HiQ was suing LinkedIn in response to the cease and desist letter, and they were suing them not for money or damages, but just to get
access,
to be allowed onto LinkedIn system, mm-hmm. a preliminary injunction. And the judge in August ruled in HiQ's favor and said, LinkedIn, you cannot— not only can you not, invoke this federal law to keep them off your system, you can't even use these technological measures to keep them off, which is, that's fairly unprecedented. There's this kind of, I think in a way it's more than HiQ even wanted, because there is this kind of cat and mouse game that goes on between the Facebooks and the LinkedIns and these smaller guys who are scraping their data. But the judge said, you can't even do that. You have to give them wide open. You have to just leave the door wide open to these guys.
Okay, so Microsoft's pretty powerful. Are they appealing?
Yes. Yeah. They're appealing to the Ninth Circuit. I think that'll be heard, early next year. And we'll see. I mean, I think the precedent is more in LinkedIn's favor. These sorts of CFAA cases have tended to go the way of the company that's using the CFAA to prevent a digital trespass.
Are you seeing? Is it eventually? I mean, could it go to the Supreme Court? Could you see common law changing because of this?
Yeah, I mean, because again, there is this question of where we draw the line between what's public data that everyone can do whatever they want with, and what's private data that we can that basically can be protected and put off limits by private actors. And I think the possibility of that is why it's attracted the sort of legal talent and the attention that it has.
Is there a cautionary message in any of this for just your everyday LinkedIn user?
Well, I mean, there are all these controls on LinkedIn that allow you, you know, you can set things to be the sort of most, you know, you can basically set your LinkedIn profile to so that basically no one can see it, other than,
raise
the question of why you have a LinkedIn profile at all. But look, I mean, I think like everything else, you should be aware that on LinkedIn, you know, LinkedIn cares about you because you're the LinkedIn member, but the really lucrative customer for LinkedIn is the recruiter, and so that's who things are really geared toward, and that is just something to keep in mind when you're using LinkedIn or really any of these services, that all of us are kind of in a way the product, and that the customers are the recruiters or the advertisers who are paying to get access and visibility and tools to really slice and dice our data.
Drake Bennett, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Drake Bennett is a staff writer at Bloomberg Business Week. More Tech Tuesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. From the Amazon Echo to Google Home, smart speakers are gaining popularity, especially as high-tech gifts. Apple was on track to be the next tech titan to unveil its own speaker this holiday season with the HomePod. But the company announced last week it wouldn't be released until early 2018. It's an unusual move for Apple, one that leaves the company even further behind Amazon and Google in the smart speaker market. Joining us now to talk about that, about the HomePod delay and more, is contributing editor at Android Central, Russell Holley. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
So why was the HomePod delayed?
Well, there are a couple of different reasons. One, some of the core technologies that Apple wants to be built into this are just plain aren't ready yet. The first of those being the next generation of this AirCast technology that Apple has had for a while now. You know, the ability to send information from your phone to an Apple TV, or to send, you know, the idea is to also, you know, make it so that you can send music and things like that to this HomePod. And this next generation of this technology, it just simply isn't ready yet.
And they want to have something that'll wow people.
Right. The whole idea here, you know, because this is not just, a connected speaker. This is designed to really be, you know, a continuation of this whole ecosystem lock-in for Apple. This is going to be, you know, the best way to listen to music at home is going to happen, you know, through your iPhone with your iTunes account and, you know, connected to your subscription services for Apple. It's a way to kind of bring all of these experiences together.
Well, all right. So what's the game plan, though, going forward? I don't expect they're planning to have it for people to put in the Easter basket or anything. I mean, how, they were expecting to make a lot of money, right?
Oh yeah, I mean it's a really important thing, you know, this holiday season in particular, because Google and Amazon both have been tremendously successful in selling their connected speakers over the last, you know, 2 months, and you know, Amazon dominated last year, you know, being the only one really with a connected speaker that was in multiple price ranges. So people who wanted to only spend $30 had an option, and people who wanted to get the more expensive one also had that option. And this year, Amazon has five different options across even more price points, with video options and things like that as well. And Google has started to compete in this space, you know, tied into anything that has a Google account. So, I mean, there's no upside to Apple delaying as far as a market share, you know, because this is the kind of thing where if someone already has multiple Amazon Echoes in their home, you know, spending the $400 to $500 on a single HomePod speaker is going to be a tough sell.
So it's got to be perfect.
It's got to be perfect out of the box. There can't be any problems. And Apple knew that, and so that's why they made the delay. So that the people who do make the investment early next year, you know, they'll be able to say that they have something that can't be replicated on these other speaker systems.
Were there any early reviews of the HomePod?
Not really yet. You know, this is something where, you know, this has only been available to a couple of people inside of Apple's press events. You've been able to kind of see it and take pictures of it and touch it, but nobody's been able to use it for any, you know, any real amount of time outside of those environments.
Who do you think should wait for Apple's HomePod if they're, you know, wanting to get on a smart speaker?
If you own Apple everything and you don't have a home stereo system already, if you haven't, you know, kind of invested in that in your home, then this may be, you know, something that you would want to consider waiting for.
Okay. You also wanted to talk about a new crowdsourced laptop called the Eve V. Evie?
Yeah, I have trouble not accidentally calling it Evie and laughing because that's the name of a Pokemon. But this is something that genuinely surprised me because I have this kind of gut reaction where I eye roll anytime that I see that someone is building a laptop on Kickstarter because by and large, tech projects don't belong on Kickstarter. But this is a laptop that has been, you know, from the beginning crowdsourced. You know, the funding has come entirely from buyers who were interested in a laptop from a new manufacturer, and each one of those people have had the ability to submit feedback to Eve, the company, for what they wanted to see in this laptop, the colors that they wanted to see in the design on the outside, the, you know, how they wanted the keyboard to sit on the design, and it is finally, after a bit of a wait, ready to ship, and it's very similar in a lot of respects to Microsoft's Surface laptops. But it's on average, you know, for how the builds are set up, almost $900 cheaper.
How did they do that? I mean, how did they manage that?
A lot of this comes from, you know, where they were able to source parts, how they were assigned how they were assembled, the fact that they are a very small company. Mm-hmm. Microsoft has a lot of research and development in software with things like the Surface Pen and their special attaching keyboards that are a little different here, you know, but as far as the size goes, this is, you know, very similar in, you know, as far as the shape and size of the hardware to, you know, a Surface laptop, the keyboard feels very good. And if people are able to actually go and buy one in a store one day, I think it'll end up being very successful. But right now it's only available, or it's only going to be available on the Eve Tech website.
Okay, so you said that crowdsourcing isn't usually a very good idea when it comes to something tech-related. Why is that?
Because, you know, all of this stuff, the just about everything that you see on a Kickstarter, you know, or an Indiegogo or something like that for tech, this is all commodity hardware. It can be purchased, you know, or designed to spec in factories all over China and in many places in the U.S. For very, very cheap. What you end up doing 99% of the time when you're actually participating in a tech Kickstarter is you're pre-ordering something. You're you know, putting money down for something that you might get in the future. And unfortunately, there's a high failure rate for a lot of these where you either aren't getting what you were promised in, you know, the initial video that you saw that led you to hit the pre-order button, or the company on several occasions just kind of ceases to exist because they spent all of their money and weren't able to successfully complete a process.
So what differentiates Evie's from the rest of the gang? I mean, what were you getting differently besides things like, you know, what color the laptop was going to be?
No, really, that's what it comes down to, is that this company was just very communicative with their audience. They, you know, they were very much, you know, every step of the way, this is what's possible, this is what we, you know, they aimed correctly as far as what they wanted for price. They listened to their audience. This could have very easily been, you know, another story of failure, but this company had a very clear mission from the beginning. And they made every step of the process very clear to their audience, and they were able to pull it off.
For how much?
They start at $799, and then they go up as high as $1,500, depending on what hardware you want it in and what accessories you want to come with it, which, again, the $1,500 version is almost spec for spec the same as a $2,500 Surface Surface Pro. So it's you know, as far as the pricing goes there, it is very aggressive and competitive. Unfortunately, you're not going to be able to just kind of buy one. If you weren't a part of the original crowdfunding campaign for this, then you have to participate in what are called flash sales, which basically means the company has a design spec for this, and they're only able to afford ordering maybe 500 or 600 of them at a time. And so they're going to order those 500 or 600 and have them available to order for minutes at a time on their website, where you can order one, and then those will be shipped to you once they're confirmed to be ready to go. So those start on December 4th.
Okay.
And it's a bit of a lottery if you actually want to get a hold of one. But you know, we've been playing with one for a while here, and it is a surprisingly good laptop for what you're paying for.
Yeah. All right. So how did you get one? Just because you guys are tech reviewers and
The company has been, we've been, you know, talking to them for a while, because this has been a project that has been for quite a while. I think its original name was I can't even remember. I think it was called Pyramid Flipper. It had a very odd name in the beginning.
They all have odd names.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So this is, you know, but it's a real thing now, and it's cool to see something like this be successful.
And you think they'll be able to keep up with demand because they'll only have these flash sales outside of the people that pre-ordered?
I think that, you know, as a start, there are very few people who know, you know, what this laptop is. So they're going to deliver to that kind of initial audience of people who are very eager first. Hopefully they will be able to, you know, to use that to grow a little bit so that they can eventually have them available on Amazon or something like that. But for now, yes, the flash sales are going to be how they can get a hold of things.
And do you know who they are and where they're from?
I don't. I know very little about the actual company itself.
Okay. You also wanted to talk about a new smartphone called the OnePlus 5T. The company's called OnePlus, but they're not known for putting out groundbreaking phones, right? So what's the deal?
Well, so actually, they're groundbreaking in a very odd way.
Well, oh, okay.
The thing that OnePlus has done from the beginning is very much positioned themselves as the phone that can do everything that the expensive iPhone and Samsung phones can do, but at a significantly lower price point. You know, so the original OnePlus phones, their whole message was that you could do everything that the iPhone could do, but it was only $300 to $350, and they've continued that for a while. Unfortunately, as iPhones and Samsung phones have continued to get more expensive, so have these OnePlus phones.
Mm-hmm.
And this OnePlus 5T is now the latest version of this, you know, phone package that they've got together, where it's the same message, where we are significantly cheaper than your high-end iPhone or Samsung, and we do all of the same things, but this phone is now $500.
Okay, so how long can they keep this up before it doesn't matter anymore?
That ends up being a very, you know, frustrating question to get an answer for, because it's very complicated from a hardware and software perspective. They, you know, a lot of money goes into building the very custom version of Android that they have set up, and the hardware that they're using is increasingly, you know, higher quality to match the higher quality that we're seeing from Samsung and Apple. But as far as being able to deliver on that promise, you know, typically OnePlus has been very successful in delivering a phone that feels very high quality, very similar in experience to in this case the iPhone 8 and the Samsung Note 8, but in a significantly cheaper price point.
I mean, even the camera.
The camera ends up being very good. Not always exactly the same, but in this case, they've done a lot of work to make sure that the camera is focused on, you know, low light quality and things like that, which are big things that we've seen from Samsung and Apple this year. But they don't do, you know, a lot of the same. For example, the portrait mode, you know, features and things like that are not usually quite as refined as what you'd see from Apple or Samsung.
What? Okay, so it has a face recognition system to unlock the phone. I was talking with someone who really loves their face recognition system on their new, is it the iPhone X?
Yeah.
How common is that feature right now? What are you hearing from people about? What do you think of it?
So the idea behind facial recognition has been around on phones for a couple of years now, but it's always come with this caveat that it's not quite as safe as a fingerprint, not quite as safe as a password. And in a couple of cases, depending on the hardware manufacturer, could actually be defeated by just holding up a photograph of a person. Mm-hmm. So obviously, not the most secure way to protect your phone, but it's better than no password at all, which is typically the argument that you see there. Mm-hmm. What we're seeing from OnePlus is kind of not nearly as functional as Apple's Face ID technology, in that it doesn't work very well when there's not a lot of light in the room, but it is very fast. And so far, we haven't been able to trick it by showing it a photograph of ourselves. But there's a pretty significant difference in the way that Apple's Face ID works and the way that the OnePlus Face Unlock works, as far as being able to promise a certain level of security.
All right, so right around the corner, it's Thanksgiving, and of course, Black Friday and Cyber Monday are right around the next corner. What do you make of this year, and what should people be looking for, and what should they be aware of?
There's always a lot of really cool deals that come out, for things that are, just all over the place. We see, things from Sharp has a 50-inch television that's going to be $180 in a couple of places. And, Sonos speakers, if you are into Sonos speakers, are going to be very cheap. But we also always, every single year, see at least a couple of stores promise that this amazing set of tablets that they have in are now 90% off, and you can get them for anywhere from between $50 and $100. Mm-hmm. And it gets a lot of people very excited to stand in line and get this tablet that they can give to their kid. Unfortunately, almost every single time, those tablets were already priced at, $50 or $100, and they were artificially marked up so that the discount could appear to be significant.
Okay.
So the biggest thing that I warn people pretty much every year is to be very, very careful about deals on tablets. Pretty much regardless of the manufacturer, when tablets go on sale for Black Friday or Cyber Monday, and the discount is more than, say, between $30 and $100, mm-hmm. that discount is almost always either artificial or it's for a model that is 2 to 3 years old and was going to be removed from the shelves anyway because it's no longer getting software updates and things like that.
Oh, okay.
So it's always really important to do a little bit of research on the tablet in particular before you go stand in line somewhere, because they may end up just not being a very good deal.
What about this whole standing in line thing? Can't you get most? I mean, what about Cyber Monday? Isn't that the best route to go with tech anyways?
It really, really depends. Cyber Monday is one of those things that used to be a really big deal. And over the past couple of years, in particular the past 2 years, what we've seen in a lot of cases is the Black Friday deals just kind of rolling through all the way to Monday.
Okay.
Where it's really just over the course of the weekend, a lot of stores will just say, look, it's this entire 4-day span that you can go and get things. And the idea of waiting in line in a lot of places, unless it's something you are saving just a tremendous amount of money on to begin with, is always something you have to be kind of careful with when it comes to technology. But if you find something, and there are just, a ton of things being done this year between Friday and Monday, you just have to, do a little tiny bit of research and make sure that this isn't something that was previously being sold for that exact same price.
Okay, so next week we're going to start with the holiday gift guide with you, right?
Yeah, we're going to take a look at stuff for all a bunch of different ages, for kind of stuff that would be fun to get as gifts.
All right. Well, Russell Halley, until then, have a happy Thanksgiving, and thanks for joining us.
And to you and your listeners as well.
That's it for Tech Tuesday today. Thanks for listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.